though we've been placed in the position of petitioner for the purpose of this consolidated argument. Mrs. Wise was the proposed patient in the county court commitment proceedings, as well as the appellant in the Court of Civil Appeals in San Antonio. Since these cases have been consolidated today for argument, I will be presenting argument on behalf of both the petitioner in the Jones case, as well as the respondent in the Lodge case. For purposes of clarity, I will refer to both petitioner in Jones and respondent as appellant, and I will be referring to the appellee in the court below as the state. This is a mental commitment case appealed from two courts of civil appeals, presenting an identical question of law under facts which are not readily distinguishable. Both appellants were involuntarily committed under temporary orders of commitment to a state mental institution. Both appellants were released after perfecting their appeals to the courts of civil appeals, but prior to submission and oral argument. In the Lodge case, the state moved to dismiss the appeal, saying that it was moot. The San Antonio court denied the motion, applying instead two commonly recognized exceptions to the mootness doctrine. In the Jones case, the Austin court held that the release from confinement did render the case moot and refused to apply either exception recognized by the San Antonio court. This case comes then to this court as a result of a conflict between the San Antonio and Austin courts on the sole question of whether an appeal under the circumstances found in Lodge and Jones renders the appeal moot. Now, the Austin and San Antonio courts have been in somewhat of a unique position in this case, in that they have had the opportunity to examine each other's position prior to the decisions which led to petitions filed in this court. The San Antonio court in Lodge examined the Austin court's Ivy decision, rejected that decision in favor of then-Justice Greenhill's decision in Carrillo, or opinion rather, in Carrillo v. State. The Austin court, on the other hand, evaluated the Lodge decision in Jones and instead chose to reaffirm a position that it took twice before, once in the matter of Ivy and secondly in Winley v. State. I think it's noteworthy as well that the decisions relied on, or a decision relied on by the Austin court as well as by the state in their briefs, has been since reconsidered and overruled by the Fort Worth Court of Civil Appeals in June of this year. In Hollifield v. State, decided in 1977 by the Fort Worth court, the Ivy position was adopted in that opinion, and the appeal from orders of temporary commitment were dismissed as moot. However, after reconsidering their decision in light of the San Antonio court's opinion in Lodge, as well as reevaluating the Ivy decision, Fort Worth opted for the San Antonio court's position and applied both exceptions to the mootness doctrine in appeals from orders of temporary commitment. So as it now stands, there are two courts of civil appeals which recognize the legitimacy of the exceptions to the mootness doctrine in cases of the type presented here today.
Counsel, did the Fort Worth court change its position in Hollifield on a motion of rehearing or in a subsequent case?
It was in a subsequent case. It's a little bit confusing, Your Honor. It's entitled Jones v. State. But it was in a subsequent decision.
And the subsequent decision was Jones v. State also?
Yes, Your Honor. Cited June 28th of this year.
Is that cited in your brief?
No, Your Honor, it's not.
You have a citation?
I...
Well, don't bother. You might furnish it.
I do have a citation for that, Your Honor. I have to get it out of my paper. So as it now stands, then, there's two courts which recognize the legitimacy of these exceptions. There's one court that has three times denied an individual the opportunity to clear their name on appellate review of orders for temporary commitment. So the issue before this court presented today is fairly clear, Your Honors. Does the release from confinement following compulsory service of the trial court's order of commitment moot an appeal which challenges the validity of that confinement? In support, obviously the appellant's position is that the cases are not moot and the San Antonio court decision in Lodge should be affirmed. In support of that position, appellants will present three arguments. First of all, appellants contend that this court's application of the collateral consequences doctrine in the Carrillo decision is controlling and applies with equal force in appeals from orders of temporary commitment. Secondly, as a general proposition, the circumstances presented in this appeal are capable of repetition, yet will continue to evade review if these cases are declared moot. And third, appellants submit that the legislative intent evidenced in sections 39A through D of the Mental Health Code provides strong indication that the legislature recognized not only the importance but the necessity for guaranteeing an individual the right to appeal an order of temporary commitment. First, the collateral consequences doctrine. In a decision by this court in Carrillo v. State, an appeal from an adjudication of delinquency was declared not moot despite the fact that the juvenile had completed serving his sentence at the time that decision was considered by this court.
Now, juvenile eviction carries permanent consequences, does it not, as the court pointed out in Carrillo?
I believe that was part of the decision, yes.
And
that
is there anything in this that was in other words, the juvenile, the court pointed out that the record stays there. Is there anything here that she's picked up either one of these ladies or filed on again? Would this be admissible, or is anything collateral consequence?
Well, appellants would contend that there are some permanent effects that result from an order of temporary commitment, and that it's no less,
should be given
consideration than those consequences which attach to an adjudication of
delinquency. Well, the juvenile conviction can be considered as part of, if he's picked up again, the prior conviction is admissible in setting the punishment for the second stage, which is pretty strong. The record remains permanent, open to the media, and is anything here that on the second, second trial would be admissible that someone has been picked up before or has been committed temporarily before?
I would think that under the rules of evidence it perhaps might very well be admissible insofar as a second trial is concerned. Certainly what the consequences that the court was concerned with in the Carrillo decision, I believe Justice Greenhill noted that the juvenile's records, despite the fact the legislature had provided the juvenile's records be sealed after the 18th birthday and provided other legislative protections, that nonetheless the consequences were not insignificant. I think it's also interesting to note that in the Jones case decided by the Fort Worth Court of Civil Appeals, they analogize very closely to what you seem to be addressing, which is somewhat of an enhancement theory, to Section 40 of the Mental Health Code. In fact, that was the primary thrust of the Fort Worth decision. Section 40 of the Mental Health Code provides that a person who has been subjected to orders of temporary commitment for a period of 60 days preceding, during the 12 months preceding an application for indefinite commitment, is a necessary prerequisite to the filing of such an application. So it's appellant's position that is very closely analogous to the enhancement theory that was recognized in Carrillo, which has also been recognized by the Court of Criminal Appeals in discussing collateral consequences which result from criminal convictions.
Now, do you regard mental illness as a crime?
No, Your Honor, we don't.
Do you regard it as a... Is it a mental disease? Is that a like any other disease, or what is it about mental illness that needs to have the court clear a person of having had a mental illness?
Well, the major distinction that appellants raise is, first of all, that these are orders which must serve in a compulsory fashion, and secondly, that they have attached to them certain stigma, adverse social consequences, which as a point of fact has been recognized by virtually every court that has considered questions involving commitment to state mental institutions. Now, in the Carrillo decision, by way of analogy, the court held that those consequences were significant to establish a juvenile's right to clear themselves by appeal, and that moreover, the court
found... The Carrillo case was a crime, was it not?
It was a crime and brought in the context of a civil adjudication. I might point out that traditionally the juvenile justice system...
Yeah, but the Supreme Court of the United States has overruled us on that.
On what?
When you bring a minor into court, the criminal rules apply. He's got to have counsel, proper warning, and all that sort of thing.
Yes, sir. That's right. And the but what the distinction in this case that we are the point we're trying to make here is that what we're talking about is a right, a threshold right, to appellate review, and that the collateral consequences that attach in the form of adverse social stigma has been recognized by the authority cited in the brief to be as severe as that which results from criminal conviction or adjudications of delinquency. In fact, some of the studies indicate that the consequences are even more severe.
Are any of these cases involving alcoholics?
Not that I'm aware
of. Not the one before the court.
No, sir.
To ask you all about Section 40 of the Mental Health Code, if the Austin court ruling were to be upheld in that case and the court dismissed it as moot, then that, as I understand, dismisses under our procedure the entire case. And I would presume then that you could not use that commitment as a prerequisite under Section 40.
Yes, Your Honor, that's a possibility.
And you wouldn't have that collateral consequence if that were the case.
As a matter of fact, if the court takes the position that the orders are to be dismissed and set aside, it is entirely arguable that any legal penalties might very well be taken care of by a decision on mootness. But what appellants would contend is that there is one adverse consequence on which a dismissal for mootness can have absolutely no effect, and that is the stigma that is imposed as a result of the commitment, which affects not only how they are viewed in the community, but their employment opportunities as well.
Well, the appeal wouldn't correct that stigma, would
it? Well, as a matter of fact, appellants contend that it's perhaps the only thing that a person who has been committed wrongfully and been forced to suffer commitment in a state mental hospital would have to vindicate themselves and to say that the trial court was wrong in that instance and that they never should have been committed in the first place. Now, admittedly, it might not cure that 100% in the minds of a particular individual in the community.
Employer, let's say.
Exactly, but legal remedies, Your Honor, are quite often not 100% adequate. For example, a personal injury case, an award of damages does not really make a person whole insofar as an amputated leg or loss of eyesight is concerned.
Well, like Ms. Jones, they wasn't moot and then affirmed the case.
That's exactly right. In that case, the Fort Worth court recognized sort of a dual benefit there, not only to the individual, but to society as well. That is, if you're going to have legal consequences attached to an order of commitment, it ought to be in cases where it's justified, rather than removing all those legal consequences whenever it's...
Well, counsel, on that point, let me follow up with the questions that you've been asked. Why is not a dismissal for mootness, which rubs out the case entirely, as Judge Garwood had just pointed out, why is that not as much vindication as a successful appeal?
Well, I think that perhaps the example in this case that presented in the Lodge case would point out, dramatize perhaps, the need for some sort of vindication on the part of the person who's been wrongfully committed. In that instance, the statement of facts indicates that the state tried to meet its burden by asking no more than 3 questions of a single witness. Indeed, the trial court judge felt constrained to admonish the assistant district attorney to have his witness identified for the record. Despite that, and over the objections of the appellant, the trial court went ahead and committed the individual. She decided that she wanted to appeal the case in order to vindicate herself.
Your complaint then is that this person has been adjudicated so that she had to go to the institution. And what you are seeking is a correction of that adjudication. so that the adjudication on appeal will be set aside.
Exactly.
The same thing, I take it, was what happened in, well, the Santana case, for instance. There was a child that was tried as a juvenile and was convicted of rape on a rule of preponderance of the evidence. It went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, no, the rule is there was doubt. The case comes back to this court, and this court did not dismiss it as moot. Sent it back for a dismissal, so there would be an adjudication wiping out this prior adjudication of guilt. Now, that's what you're seeking.
Yes, Your Honor, we're seeking a decision on the merits.
That's right.
So an affirmative statement by an appellate court, not only the benefit...
To correct an error that was made about Ms. Jones.
Exactly. Simply stated, a decision on mootness would have absolutely no effect insofar as telling the trial court what it was they had done wrong in that case. It would provide no guidance for a trial court, no matter how egregious the error might have been that it complained of. And it, so not only does the individual seek vindication, but I think there's a question of public policy here, that there be some means for giving the trial court instruction on what the proper law is in these cases. So it really goes beyond just a mere dismissal. It goes beyond reaching an affirmative decision on the merits. Provide the trial court with guidance and provide the appellant with vindication in the event that the trial court was wrong.
Is the
90
days?
Yes, Your Honor. Under the statute, they can be committed for a maximum period of 90 days.
Have cases reached the appellate court, the courts of civil appeals, and been disposed of within the 90 days? Is this a situation where it's impossible for any temporary commitment to ever get appellate review?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that would be necessarily impossible. I think there's absolutely no circumstances under which some individual in the state might not be able to secure appellate review, particularly if the Court of Civil Appeals did suspend all of its rules and advance the case on its docket and determine it within a very short period of time.
Doesn't the statute provide and require an expedition on the appeal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, on a long record, it takes a great deal of expedition to get a case from the trial court to the Supreme Court of Texas in 90 days, don't you think?
That's exactly the position that you come to take in this case, Your Honor.
We seldom see one of those cases up here.
As far as the ultimate determination of the law in these cases, it would probably be impossible for this court ever to consider a case in 90 days, so you would be confronted with a situation that even if the Court of Civil Appeals accepted and determined the case, what if the Court of Civil Appeals made a wrong decision? This court would be denied the opportunity to tell the Court of Civil Appeals to find the law or the facts, rather get the law wrong in that case, and would also deny the Court of Civil Appeals or the trial court's benefit. Receiving the decision matter as well as, again, denying both benefits to the individual defendant. Now, this sort of leads me into the second argument that has been presented in support of recognizing the second commitment doctrine and committing the appeal to be prosecuted. That's the exception first recognized by the U.S. Supreme Court in the Southern Pacific Terminal case. Which I refer to, or will refer to, as the Southern Terminal exception. This exception authorizes a court to hear and determine a case which might otherwise be moot if the facts giving rise to the dispute are capable of repetition that will evade review because of the short duration of the dispute. Now, as Justice Garwood pointed out a few minutes ago in his question, when he asked him whether or not it was possible for any of these cases to be decided, admittedly some cases probably could, decided in the court of civil appeal. But the point is, what happens as a matter of general practice? Not only can the court, but this court never consider those decisions, but as a general rule, most of these cases will never even reach the court of civil appeal, given the reality of the appellate doctrine. In order to invoke this exception, appellants can satisfy three requirements. First of all, they must show that the dispute results from short-term orders, or that a significant fact in the litigation is of short duration, causing the dispute to evade review. Secondly, the circumstances must be capable of repetition. And third, the dispute must concern matters public significance. With respect to the first requirement, as has been pointed out, the orders are inherently short-term. They last a maximum period of only 90 days. But in point of fact, the effective duration of these orders is quite often much shorter, since the proposed patient under the mental health code may be discharged at any time subject to the recommendation of the treating physician. Indeed, Lisa Jones was only ordered by the trial court in the first place to be committed for a maximum period of 60 days, and this is why she ordered the living sentence being retained only 13 days after 90 days commitment. Again, given the reality of the appellate doctrine, there's no way to bring this case to the court in such a short period of time. But if there is a way, it's going to be utilized only in a rare number of instances. Appellants would contend that they also satisfy the second requirement of this exception, that the circumstances are capable of repetition for two reasons. First of all, it's demonstrated in the record in both of these cases that these individuals have been hospitalized on prior occasions the longer period of time being between 2 and 3 weeks. So if they have been forced to go through this in the past, and it is not unlikely that they could be forced in the same circumstances in the future. And Jones believes the doctor testified in the first time hospitalization for between 2 and 3 weeks, and while the record reflects that there were 2 prior hospitalizations, one of which lasted only 7 days. Additionally, just looking at the scheme of things and the code itself, these circumstances are simply going to be repeated because the orders the maximum duration is short to get them up on the field. With respect to the third requirement, the courts have considered civil commitment cases as unanimous decisions. These cases represent cases of substantial public significance involving the individual's protected liberty. In the past 5 years alone, the U.S. Supreme Court has decided cases involving commitments to state mental institutions and held that only state acts infringe on protected liberty interests involved cannot do so without any absence of due process of law.
As everybody gets settled, we hear argument from Relator.
May it please the court, Mr. Moore will present argument from Relator.
It may please the court, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Frank Moore from Irving, Texas, and I'm here representing the Relator in this writ of habeas corpus. First of all, I appreciate the honor and the opportunity to appear here before you. And in my brief, I have stated 6 points of error. To start out with, the parties were divorced on about the 20th of May, 1975. There was an amendment to the judgment that was entered into on the 18th of September, 75. Motion for contempt was filed May 21, 1980. And a hearing on the motion was held the 19th of June, 1980. And he was confined in jail as of 19 June, 1980. The first point of error, I allege, is that the trial court erred in finding the ruler later in contempt because the motion for contempt in that the pleadings were not adequate. If the court would look at the pleadings, the motion for contempt, first of all, was nowhere in the motion for contempt is he ordered to show cause. It merely states out the a portion of the amended order of the 18th of September but does not ask that he appear and show cause, nor anywhere does it ask anything that he be held in contempt of court or that he be confined in jail. All it merely says is there was a portion of an order, it recites it, and that tells him to come to court. And since the contempt actions are quasi-criminal in nature, according to Cardwell and several other cases that have been cited, and in Judge Greenhill's article on habeas corpus, I feel that these type of pleadings, even though there is some latitude in pleadings in domestic relations court, these type of pleadings do not tell the realtor what he has done or ask for the type of relief that was granted. It totally is void of proper notice. And I think that on that point that the situation is such that the failure to notify him of that is not due process and does not meet the test of the Cardwell and other cases of a quasi-criminal problem in these things, and that as such should be overruled, and the court did not have jurisdiction in that. It says that due process for punishment, and since they are quasi-criminal, due process requires that he be notified since they are that way. The other thing is that there is a second order, and he only recites part of the amendment, not of the full order. And I think it's up on the movement in those cases to recite the complete order, as to tell him what he was supposed to have done in the motion for contempt. The only thing that we have in that motion for contempt basically is the statement that child support was not paid, does not say how it was paid or was not paid or where it was to be paid. That you have to go to another piece of paper to find. On point two, that the page and volume is not there. Again, this is not notice as to where and why, where he would go to find out. The second part of the amended order does not even have a date on the top of it. So if he is served with a motion for contempt and they recite that point, he's got to know where to go. Now, we as members of the bar may know what it means, but he as a layman, I present to you, would not know exactly what he was supposed to do in that case. And so consequently, the failure to, again, ex parte Cardwell, that this is quasi-criminal in nature, does not notify him of that. The point three is the inability to pay. Now, throughout the transcript, if the court has read the transcript, there is some allocations from the wife. One, that he wasn't, I think they said in his briefs, that he wasn't sleeping with me, so he's not paying. That has nothing to do with the pay. The only evidence from him in trial, and he was there without counsel, was that he would pay when he got it. I didn't represent him until after this all happened, but he said he would pay when he got it. And there was evidence in the trial that he was supposed to receive a settlement sometime in the future. What the test is, the ability to pay now, not in the future. He must be able to pay now. And that's set forth in 424 Silver 2nd 891, which is in the brief. He testified that he was a disabled veteran. He was not working at that time. He was supposed to start receiving payments, and he had received one check. But nowhere, and he kept saying that he would pay when he got the money. But he didn't have the money. And the test is not what he could have done in the future or might have done in the past on the coercive part of the order. On the penalty part, perhaps, but not on that part. And I think that the evidence clearly shows that he did not have the ability to pay. point four, when I first went to Collin County, I could find no commitment order. And in Mr. Terry's brief, he presents the court with one. And it appeared to me as if it might be questioned as to why it is. So I was upset with it. It's my integrity, it appears, may have been questioned. So I went to the Collin County Courthouse, and they have transferred this case to Fannin County. And I have a certified copy of a letter, which I'm going to leave the court when I leave today, showing that at the time I went there, there was no commitment order in the file. I called Fannin County.
Counsel, are you asking to supplement the record? Is that what you're saying?
Well, Your Honor, I am not, this is for my own benefit. In reading the brief, it appeared to me like I may have tried to mislead the court.
For your benefit, it's not particularly helpful to us. You want to supplement the
record? No, Your Honor, I'm not going to supplement the record, other than the fact that in Mr. Terry's brief, he said something about he didn't know why I couldn't find it. And I didn't want the court to think that I had gotten here by a misrepresentation, because at the time I went, there was none in there. There was no commitment order. I am not contesting the fact there is one now.
Was there a commitment order at the time that he was committed?
There was a commitment order, but it was not in the file, Your Honor. It was logged into the, if the court will look at it, it was logged into the Sheriff's Department, not the clerk's office. And so consequently, that was one of my points of error, that there was no commitment order. And I'm not contesting the fact there was one. It just was not in the file, and I didn't know about it at the time I filed it. And that's all I'm trying to do. I would contest the fact of its validity, because the order of contempt states that he will pay fines, spend some time in jail, or pay the arrearage. The order of commitment says and stay in jail. So there's a variance between the commitment order and the order of contempt. And it's my position that the order of commitment would be void, because it does not track the order of the court, which I think is plain and in all issues. And in fact, if once the party has been placed in custody, it is my understanding that the sentence starts to run, and the court thereby loses the power to reform its judgment. This is set forth in Benz versus U.S., which is 282 Southwest 2nd 304, and also in Brown, Ex Parte Brown, which is a Texas case, 574 Southwest 2nd 618, saying the court does not have the power to go back and change the order if they're going to increase the punishment. In this case, the commitment order would increase the punishment, so it does not track the statute there. As I said, the order says that he is to pay a fine, spend some time in jail, or to pay the child support and pay some attorney's fees. He has paid his fine. He has spent his time in jail, and yet the sheriff still refused to release him. To me, just reading the order would be plain as to why he should be released at that time. It's punitive. The order's punitive. He's done the punitive portion of it, and he should be released. The main point of the case, in point six, is that prior to the proceedings in Collin County, the realtor had been found guilty of criminal non-support in Fannin County, placed on probation, and then after that, the contempt proceedings were initiated, which placed him in jail. This, in our position, is
is in a different court than the...
Yes, Your Honor. The contempt proceedings was in Collin County. The non-support was in Fannin County. Now, there is a certified copy in the court's jacket of the order from Fannin County holding him in the criminal matter. There is a case directly in point on this in the Ex Parte Brown case I cited earlier, which is 574 Southwest 2nd 618. In that case, a party was found to be in contempt of court for two items, one for non-payment of child support and two for violating of a permanent restraining order in which he had had physical contact with his ex-wife. All right, the court in that case, he paid his child support to purge himself of that portion of the contempt. When it come to the court on the punitive court for having an altercation with his ex-wife, it was shown that he had previously pled guilty to a criminal act for assault and had paid a fine or placed on probation, and the court in that case said the Fifth Amendment probation against double jeopardy precludes punishment by contempt proceedings for contempt for which defendant has already been punished under state laws and criminal proceedings. They cited in that case Menon versus New York, which is a case in which in New York, and this case has gone to the Supreme Court of the United States, Menon versus New York. And I have the cite here. 96 Supreme Court 241. In that case, a person had refused to testify before a grand jury, and they had held him in contempt and had sentenced him to 30 days for contempt of court. They later, under New York law, have a criminal action in which he can be sentenced under a criminal statute for failure to testify. And the Supreme Court of the United States says that that was double jeopardy.
Now, counsel, that's not what the court said. I read it, didn't it?
It said
we remanded to the court of New York and expressed no interest as to whether it is double jeopardy or not.
I think, Your Honor, that they said they was. I see there was. Part of the judges had wanted had sent it back to determine if there was, I believe, and I followed it up, and the New York court said there was double jeopardy. And the Supreme Court, one of the judges, wanted to completely reverse it, but he was in the minority. But in that case, it was also cited in the Brown case in Texas. So this is the precedent that we have that it is double jeopardy. And we have some other cases in Texas that are very similar to this in our juvenile proceedings. And there are several cases. One of them, Deering versus State, 204 Southwest 2nd, 983, in which a juvenile for an act, I forget the act, I think it was a burglary, was alleged a delinquent for that one specific act. The court held he could not later be charged in a criminal action for that same identical act. Now, if there are multiple prosecutions, multiple offenses, and they find him delinquent on one, it does not preclude him from being tried on another one, but for the same specific act. And in this case here, the act or the crime that he was charged and convicted with or pled guilty to in Fannin County was failure to support his two children and failure to pay child support. That's the same identical facts, same elements that there are in the contempt action. And it's our position that it is a double jeopardy. Anything else? That's all I have, Your
Honor. Thank you, counsel. Your argument, Ms. Palmer.
May it please the court, Mr. Chair, to present argument for a respondent.
May it please this honorable court, counsel. I'll leave the largest portion of my comments to the brief and answer that we've submitted. I will make a few brief comments and respond to any questions that the court may have. In relators points 1 and 2, I understand that the complaint is of the sufficiency of the pleadings in this matter and of the failure of the motion of petitioner to allege a book and page number so as to give proper notice to the relator. I would point out just about three things about the pleadings. I point out the fact that the order that these pleadings arose out of, the 1975 amended order for support, was an agreed order wherein the parties to this lawsuit entered into an agreement about support. Point out the fact that there's no testimony that relator didn't understand what that order provided. I understand that relator is complaining about a failure of due process. I believe the law is that due process demands that relator be given notice of the charges that are alleged against him and that he have an opportunity to respond to those charges. I believe that the pleadings in this case, which are on a part of the application for writ of habeas corpus, show that it's clearly stated that the complaint is that he hasn't paid his child support ever since the order was entered, and sets out the relevant parts of those pleadings that we complain of. And of course, the testimony shows that the relator was in court and testified to all the matters that he wanted to testify to in the district court. Point three, with regard to inability, I'll leave to the brief, except to say that from the sites that have given in our response to the transcript, it just seems clear to me that there's not only been no showing that relator's not able to pay, so that reasonable minds couldn't differ about that issue, but it seems to be just the opposite of that. The court invited the relator in the original hearing in the district court to assign these workman's comp benefits, and the relator at that time said no, he wouldn't be willing to do that. There's no testimony that he's not able to borrow money, that he didn't have family members that he could approach for those funds, that he doesn't have credit, that he doesn't have property, even that I noticed that he's not able to pay. Point four is to the commitment order. We've attached a copy there, and I believe should take care of that point.
Counsel, does the commitment order, excuse me, is the commitment order in the record before us? I don't know what it is or not.
I don't believe there's a record here.
Ordinarily you're in trouble if there's not a commitment order.
Pardon?
I say ordinarily you'd be in trouble if there's no commitment order. One of the requirements.
The commitment order is in the record, and it's in the record before this court.
That's what I asked you. Okay. I had understood counsel for Lator to say it was not in the record. He wasn't offering it in the record.
All right. I don't believe it is the complete transcript of this call has been offered into the record, and I'm not aware that it has been.
Let me put it this way. To simplify, do you and counsel for Lator agree that there was a commitment order, and the order which is attached is a copy of it?
I believe that's what counsel for Relator has said.
Mr. Moore, do you agree to that?
Yes, Your Honor, I do agree to that.
No problem.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
What about the provision in the commitment order, the judgment, as to how he should purge himself, the R instead of the N?
Of course, that raises the next point. I understand that one of the problems that the Court of Civil Appeals, Justice Guittard, saw in the order of commitment, that it says that he's to pay a fine, serve 24 hours, or serve in a sentence until he's purged himself of contempt and that he's paid attorney's fees, paid his arrearage, and paid the fine and cost the court. The commitment order does say that that he's to do those things, but it's to serve the 24 hours and to serve thereafter until he's purged his self of contempt and doing those things. Justice Guittard stated that the only problem he saw was there was a 24-hour period of time where there could be some vagueness about that order, that the relator may not have known during that 24-hour time whether or not he could be discharged during that 24 hours by paying the arrearage and paying the attorney's fees and paying the costs and paying the fines. Thereafter, the point becomes moot. The application shows that he's served his 24 hours and that he's also not paid the amounts due to purge himself of contempt. So it's become moot after that 24 hours, as we see it. I see the commitment order. I understand the law to be that where there's a problem with construction of a judgment, here's an order that appears to say that he can serve 24 hours or thereafter, or of course, as long as he's not purged himself of contempt. I understand that there's to be a construction of that judgment so that an application of the fact shows a common sense reading of it. And here I believe that the commitment order, simply the written commitment that we're referring to, simply clarifies that the jailer is to hold that man in jail until he purges himself of contempt.
You think the
over and above 24 hours.
You think the and clarifies the or?
I simply say that I believe it clarifies the what the judge had in mind when he signed that original order. I don't believe it's a departure from it. After the 24 hours, it would seem to become moot.
The word or, until he purges himself of contempt, in that he has and then lists some things, is in the judge's handwriting.
That's true.
So you can't say he was confused.
I would correct you. This is not in the record, but that's my handwriting. And that would have been, if there's a mistake, my mistake, not the judge's. He signed it, but the handwriting is mine on that order that was presented to me at the court.
So you clarified that, though, in the commitment order.
No, I didn't clarify. That wasn't my... The commitment order is not my handwriting. But I say that these are... I'd say that the commitment order lends a common sense construction of the original order, that it was to be, that he was to serve not only 24 hours, but thereafter until he purges himself of contempt. It seems to be a mistake of the party.
How it becomes moot in 24 hours? You have it in front of you, what it says?
Excuse me.
I don't understand how it would become moot in 24 hours. Do you have a copy of it?
And of course, that's just my statement. My idea is that yes, I do, Your Honor. I have it here. I see that it says he's to pay a $100 fine to serve 24 hours or until he purges himself of contempt and that he's done these four things. During the initial 24 hours, I can see that there'd be some question, can I be released from jail if I pay the $9,280, the $56, and the $300? Thereafter, it seemed to be moved. He served his 2 days. He hadn't paid those items that he's got to pay to purge himself. So it's clear at that time what he's to do. He's to serve until he pays.
Can he pay the $100? Did he pay the $100?
I don't know, Your Honor. It seemed like he may have attached a receipt to his application showing that he had. I'm not... is there anything in the record that indicates that he has?
Counsel, I don't find that the commitment order... You have the commitment order there.
Is that not attached, Your Honor? I have a copy of it.
Well, this is the record, and I do not find the commitment order in the record. Just pull it out from your file. I don't want your file.
All right. Sure.
It seems to be attached to the brief.
It was not in the record. I called the Collin County clerk and said that that relator has said that there's no commitment order in the record and asked her if there was, and she said, yes, there is, and I said, would you please mail me a copy of that? And she did, a certified copy. So I attached that to my brief just to indicate to the court that apparently there is a commitment order in the record.
One of you gentlemen, ask Mr. Jackson to come up here and bring his file stamp with it, and let's get this settled.
Here's
the
file.
Well, I'm gonna file that. Since agree, if you all think it's correct, since they've agreed to it.
We're gonna leave. Questions, or should we? Should I proceed about the other points? I just have a couple other comments.
Let me ask one more question about this.
All right.
The order holding respondent in contempt was entered by which court, which county?
By the Collin County Court. It was at that time that we had made a motion to the court in conjunction with the motion for contempt to have it transferred to Fannin County.
Again, when was it then transferred, or was it later?
Transferred after the hearing in Collin County.
In relation to the order holding him in contempt, when was it transferred? Before or after?
After.
It was transferred after then. The order holding him in contempt was entered.
Yes, it was.
Signed and entered.
Yes.
Okay, and then it was transferred. Who signed the order of commitment? Which county?
The order of commitment was signed by Judge McCraw in Collin County before it was transferred.
Before it was transferred?
Yes.
Okay.
The order transferring was signed on the same day, but these proceedings all took place, and then thereafter the matter was transferred by order signed by the court.
It was an order of contempt and a commitment order, and then it was transferred?
That's correct.
In the meantime, he's still in jail, though, in Collin County.
Yeah.
Or was at that time?
He was at that time.
As to a relator's point about double jeopardy, I've found no cases in point. He says that the Brown case is in point. I think there are some differences in that case and in the present case. Here, I've cited to the court in my brief to this Winfrey case, which discusses the quasi-criminal nature of a motion for contempt, but also cites the differences, and I'll leave those points to the brief. But I think what is important is here we have a continuing situation whereby every month that the support's not paid, I understand, to constitute a separate element of contempt. If the monthly payment's not paid, he's in contempt of the court for not paying it. The only thing that I can see that the relator's argument can persuade us of is the fact that somehow if you're convicted of criminal non-support, that deprives the district court of the power to enforce his order of support, and that in spite of the fact that he's never paid any support. Was sentenced to jail, went to jail, but got out of jail and hadn't paid any support thereafter. And those facts are supported by the transcript. I just don't believe that's the law in Texas.
What you're saying is he committed contempts that were after his criminal conviction.
Yes. In other words,
but
the criminal...
But he has been under your construction of the order, though. He's been the coercive element of the contempt applies to all the arrears, which would include that had been the subject of the criminal proceeding.
That is true, Your Honor. There's been a continuing contempt, and the $9,000-plus is, of course, for the full years. He's never paid any of that. The only reason he was placed in jail, placed in jail, was until he should pay the support that that court in Fannin County ordered. He was released from jail, according to testimony in the transcript, based with the understanding that he was to pay the support then, and he still didn't pay it.
Well, supposedly then he's still liable to the to that court.
Certainly, I'd understand that any amount that he paid on the support ordered by the Collin County Court would be applied to this judgment, the $9,000. If he paid it in Fannin County in response to that order, certainly that would purge him of the necessity of paying it again in the Collin County Court. So we're just saying that to say that that court can't put him in jail for failure to obey its order is to say that it's deprived the jurisdiction to enforce its order. Or apparently you'd have to say further that there's no longer any necessity for the relator to pay any support, and particularly to pay the amount of arrears if the court can't enforce its order. And with that, we're asking the court to deny this application for writ of habeas corpus and to remand the relator, Charles Englert, for the sheriff of Collin County until he purges himself of contempt in conformance with the court's order and order of commitment.
Counsel, one thing that I just don't know the law on. The order of the judge, not the commitment order, the order after the trial, which finds him in contempt, rather clearly says he's assessed a fine of $100 and confinement in the county jail for a period of 24 hours, or until he purges himself of contempt by doing this, this, and this. In other words, do one or the other. Now, the commitment order says and. Now, must the commitment order follow the order of the court finding him in contempt?
Your Honor, I'll, to be frank with you, I hadn't noticed that until this was raised by a respondent at this podium, and I simply would say that I don't know whether it has to precisely track it. The order states, and the commitment order that was sent to me did not have, but the commitment order states that a copy of the original order is attached thereto. If that's going to get outside the record.
No, but you're not outside the record. It says that in the commitment order.
It says that there.
That's set out in the attached copy of the judgment.
Yes, but the commitment order that I received, I don't believe had that order attached to it. Whether it actually was or that's just an omission of the clerk and sending me that, I don't know. If it's there, I certainly think that the order itself would be the basis for the commitment. And if it's attached, that commitment would conform with the original order. And I think, again, it seems to me that adds a common sense construction of that original order. I don't believe it's any. Doesn't seem to me there's a lot of question that the choice wasn't 24 hours or this other, but it was at the 24 hours or thereafter until he, or and thereafter until he purged.
We kind of.
If the scrivener's made an error, why didn't you get a judgment enough for something correct the clerical error of writing or instead of and? That's what the judge rendered.
The reason I haven't, and I thought about that, Your Honor, is the fact that here we are now on a writ of habeas corpus. The relator's out of jail, and he's saying, on that order, I shouldn't have been in jail. It was my thought that the court wouldn't be able to correct that on a judgment non pro tem. Maybe I was in error, but that was my reasoning. I'm through, but I feel like if there's no further questions.
Ms. Jackson, counsel have agreed this is a copy of the order given the sheriff. Would you please put your file mark on it and put it in the papers?
Yes, sir.
In that color right there.
Yes, sir.
Rebuttal argument from the relator.
I apologize to the court for the confusion about the commitment order, but it was not in the file, and since it was in existence, I certainly would not
court appreciates
mislead the court. In regard to the, in the Court of Civil Appeals, when it was pointed out and it had the or matter, I think the court would look in the record that he paid the fine after that time, so that he paid the $100 after we had been in the Court of Civil Appeals, so he had performed the portion of the order of contempt that would release him, in our opinion, since he paid the $100 fine and had spent the time in jail, then he had performed one or the other, which is in our reading of the order. It's further argued that the commitment order should at least track the order of commitment, and it does not. If there was an error, as Mr. Terry pointed out, if he drew this is what the judge signed, this is what he presented
I think it does not his position at this point to complain of what he himself drew in his own handwriting. In regard to the double jeopardy, the Fannin court, realtor is still under the jurisdiction of that court. They have filed a motion to revoke his probation in that case. So consequently, if he's in jail in McKinney for contempt of court for not paying child support, then they try to put him in jail in Fannin County for violation of his probation. Where is he going to do anything? If he's out on one, he's in on the other. If he's out on one, he can't pay Fannin County if he's in jail in McKinney. And he can't pay McKinney if he's in jail in Fannin County.
Has he thought of supporting his kids?
Well, Your Honor, I think the record shows that he had said that he would pay him as soon as he got his money, that he would try to support him.
I thought he testified that he wasn't going to support any woman he wasn't living with.
No, Your Honor. That was his wife's testimony. That was not his testimony. He testified several times that he would pay him as soon as he got his money. It's through the record two or three different places. His wife testified to that, but not him. So that's all I have, Your Honor. Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted on written briefs. No argument from both parties. You'll be excused from the counsel table. Counsel, please come to the counsel table. Your argument from petition.
May it please the court, Mr. Corrigan will present argument for our petition.
May it please the court. I have prepared 4 one-page exhibits and furnished multiple copies to the bailiff, and I request at this time permission that those exhibits be set before the members of the court.
That's fine, except we don't have a bailiff, we got a marshal.
My apologies, Your
Honor. Okay.
This case is before the court on 2 points of error, which are closely connected, and I will argue them together. I will refer to the exhibits during the course of the argument. This lawsuit was filed by the Massachusetts Mutual Life Insurance Company seeking to rescind 2 policies of life insurance aggregating an amount $125,000 on the life of the insured Albert Mays, issued for the benefit of his wife as beneficiary, Maddie Emmeline Mays. Mrs. Mays counterclaimed for recovery of the proceeds of the policies, which the insurance company had refused to pay when the insured died on July 25, 1977. The case was tried to a jury in the 95th District Court of Dallas County, and based upon the findings of the jury, judgment was entered in favor of Mrs. Mays for recovery on the policies. That judgment was reversed by the Dallas Court of Civil Appeals, and application from that judgment for writ of error to this court has been granted. The principal point in controversy involves a clause in the policies, which is somewhat different from any that I've had occasion to see in life insurance policies before. In effect, it says that the company will have no liability unless, at the time the policy is issued, the representations made by the insured in the application for insurance are then, to the best of his knowledge, true and correct.
Is that in the policy or in the application?
It's in the application, but the application is attached to the policy, and as I understand, by operation of law, becomes a part of the law.
When you say a part of the policy, you're not intending it within the place of the policy itself?
No, in the application. The jury found in answer to special issues that certain of the answers which the insured had made in his application had become untrue prior to the time that the policy was issued. In this case, there was an interim between the submission of the application and the issuance of the policy of about 3 months. It's undisputed that at the time the application was filled out, these answers were true and correct. I'd like to very briefly review what happened during that 3 month interim. The application was made on May 6, 1976. On June 29, the insured, Mr. Mays, had an episode of chest pains. He was hospitalized overnight and treated by his personal physician, Dr. John Schilling. Dr. Schilling told him that, in his opinion, the trouble did not result from heart disease.